Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome to New Books in Sports. My name is Keith Rathbone and I'll be your host for today. I'm here with Dr. Kevin Simpson, the author of what I think is really just a cracking, fascinating book called Soccer Under the Swastika, Stories of Survival and Resistance During the Holocaust. Welcome, Kevin, and thank you very much for joining us.
Very glad to be here. Thank you.
Now, Kevin, can I ask you just to start off by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Certainly. Actually, I'm a trained psychotherapist by background. Over the years, most of my early professional experience was in counseling psychology. But as I grew to work in the field, I found that my passion for teaching really surpassed the clinical work I was doing. And so it was early enough on that I was able to kind of switch directions a bit, but I was primarily trained to be a therapist. That said, I've been teaching now for well over 20 years and have really grown to love teaching undergraduates. And so where I teach now is a private liberal arts college in Northwest Arkansas. I'm actually teaching at my alma mater called John Brown University, not named for the abolitionist for our historians in the audience, but rather for an evangelist here in the area. But just love teaching in social psychology. I've developed a specialty area in the last decade in the psychology of the Holocaust, and that is really where this book rose out of.
Great. Can you tell me then a little bit more about how this book developed, how you developed this interest in the Holocaust, and what kind of work you had to do to produce such an interesting work?
Well, I would begin by saying I'm a bit of an accidental historian, and I don't make any apologies for that because I've always loved history. I frankly wish I'd paid a bit more attention when I was an undergraduate myself in my history classes, Western Civ, that kind of thing. But I really grew into this field through the guidance of a couple of close colleagues several years ago, both of whom were historians. In fact, we developed a course together on the history and psychology of the Holocaust, and when you really get into the field, or this particular field, you realize that these are really closely compatible disciplines with which to look at the Holocaust when you consider perspectives of the victims, the social circumstances, some of the prevailing forces that not only pre-existed during the war, but certainly propelled both the war and the genocide forward. But really, the book grew out of my preparation for teaching the numerous classes I've taught, both in social psychology and then, of course, psychology of the Holocaust. I've probably taught that course now probably five or six times. It's often an alternating class, but in my schedule. But I kept coming across compelling memoirs of prisoners in camps, in ghettos even. And they were often playing soccer during their downtime if they had any. Of course, these were prisoners of the Nazi state, which was driven, of course, ultimately to exterminate as many people as they could, particularly of the Jewish descent. But kept coming across not only memoirs, but photographs of soccer existing in these places meant to destroy and kill. And it just stumped me initially, but the more I dug into the work, the archives, the literature, found more and more stories. And I realized, well, beyond maybe an initial sort of conference paper or something of that sort. There were a lot more stories here. And so what was born out of a conference paper probably 4 years ago now on the camp ghetto Terezin, which is known as the Theresian stats in the Nazi state, that turned into a book. And again, it's I really wanted to tell the story, frankly, of the survivor, of course, of those who didn't make it as well. As we get farther into this conversation, I'm certainly glad to talk about those who certainly perished, but used soccer for a time to hold on to hope. The many spectators that we learn about in the stands, in the ghettos, in the camps, were very emboldened by the soccer that was played in these places. And so it really was born out of my teaching, and then the research took off from there. Several crucial aspects of my preparation for this were fellowships that I did through the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. I also did a bit of a research stint at Yad Vashem in Jerusalem. Again, these were pivotal for developing the historical context for me. I think I was pretty familiar with basic research methods coming out of the psychological tradition, but there was a lot I needed to learn about context, how to collect and understand memoirs. I had a lot of good help in terms of translation along the way. So that was key because, frankly, I don't speak German, Hungarian, Czech, any of the other languages from which these memoirs were based. So it really was born out of my teaching.
Yeah, actually, I'd love to ask you a little bit more about how you got into all of these sources, because one of the things that I found impressive about your work is just its broad scope, encompassing soccer in occupied countries in the Netherlands, in Bohemia, and Czechoslovakia, but also all throughout the different phases of the Holocaust and in the interwar period as well. And so you just have this really broad scope. And I'd wonder if you could tell us a little bit about how you discovered so many of these sources. I know from my own research as a sports historian, it's really hard to find stories about sports because they're often not what people chose to write about because they're sometimes considered to be less important. But then you find all these interesting little nuggets about them, and it makes you curious, why was this happening, right?
Right. That's exactly it. The stories, I think, especially from the survivor perspective, were seen as maybe trivialities. It mattered to them, certainly for those who survived, because it was often a means for survival, protection, privilege, this sort of thing. But I guess part of what helped me be thorough was part of my personality, and you might expect a psychologist to say that, but it's a real desire to get the stories right, because I know that if I was too selective or if I followed a story that was too maybe sensational, I'd be really missing the broadest picture. And so I try to be, of course, historical and linear, but the stories primarily came from the prominent camps themselves. So Dachau, Auschwitz, and then the further I got into memoirs, again, some of the archivists in places like Auschwitz, Dachau, Sachsenhausen near Berlin, they were quite forthcoming with whatever testimonies they had. And honestly, they're kind of low in number or scarce rather, but really the work then meant often having to get either full transcripts or then, of course, translation of those sources once they kind of trickled in. So I didn't have a robust research budget necessarily, but I'm quite indebted to the archivists and historians at the different camps. And I was very intent on hitting all the major camps that would have been kind of the umbrella camps for all the satellites that might have existed. Mauthausen is a prime example of that in Austria. As it sits there above the Danube, it's in a geographically beautiful place. But of course, it's the most heinous of the Nazi work camps because it was the only camp that essentially was designed to starve and kill by labor in the Nazi system. But I tried to, again, be as systematic as I could with all the camps, the major ghettos. There were a lot of gaps as well. For instance, I expected to find a lot in the French camps and really came up short there. I was kind of surprised by that. I think, again, if there's a follow-up work to this, I would like to go deeper into some of those sources. But Germany and Poland And then a bit, of course, in the Czech Republic, the Czechoslovakia was where I was able to glean those resources. But I still, in fact, have a few testimonies from Sachsenhausen and Neuengamme near Hamburg that need to be looked at more deeply. But I guess my good fortune was to be handed a number of these documents because nobody was really interested in them before, especially, again, transcripts of interviews that maybe were done shortly after the war or memoirs that had been recently released. That's kind of an odd coincidence of timing here, that some of the memoirs I relied on that were really crucial to tell the story of Terezin and then also Auschwitz, even the work camp at Monowitz, came from survivors who wrote their memoirs just in the last decade or so, maybe not even that long ago. Really fantastic memoir of a man named Pavel Wiener, who was a child in Terezin, and his book came out just a few years ago as well. So I was the beneficiary of later testimonies, later memoirs as well. So yeah, that's probably the broader overview. When I think about some of the really crucial testimonies, some of them had been published in other forms. The one that still sticks with me today is the very, very brief account of the doctor who worked with Mengele at Auschwitz. He was a Hungarian doctor named Miklos Nisli. We value his work for its in-depth explanation or testimony of what was happening in the experimentation labs of Mengele, even the crematoria and the Sonderkommando, who again were tasked with that atrocious duty. There's a very brief passage in there that I corroborated with another couple of testimonies that initially we thought this was apocryphal sort of accounting by the doctor there at Auschwitz, but the game between the SS and the Sonderkommando, which again would have been very brief, maybe a moment in time, but once I was able to corroborate it with another source or two, was able to really find that this beyond belief sort of account of the Nazis actually playing the prisoners, whom again were destined to death just a few months after their service in the crematoria, just again astounded me. And so I really wanted to get the stories right and make sure they were cross-referencing that way.
Yeah, I was very impressed with the way in which you were kind of able to draw from so many different sources to create this textured account of what happened, especially in your chapter on the Liga Terezinstadt or Liga Terezin. I think let's perhaps go a little bit chronologically in the way in which your book is ordered. And let's look at the interwar period, because one of the things I found interesting is the way you're able to describe how soccer became politicized in Germany, first emerging and becoming popular after the First World War in some respects, and then becoming politicized by the Nazi state. So can you tell me a little bit about how this happened and what in particular the role of people like Hans von Schammer and Austin, who I really think has a name out of a Pynchon novel, right? How these characters were able to take this game, which previously had many people had argued for its apolitical effects, and turn it into a tool of the state.
Yes, in fact, that was one of the areas I probably ought to have mentioned earlier, that in my teaching here at John Brown, one of the first places I was able to really bring in the Holocaust, World War II, was in my social psychology class when we talk about propaganda, persuasion, and there's again a rich history of research in social psychology in this area. Some of the most famous studies that have been done in this area. But that for me was a natural draw, because I knew, of course, of the Berlin Games in 1936, how the Nazis were able to essentially keep the forces of resistance basically worldwide, boycotts, this sort of thing, at arm's length, because they could really choreograph and orchestrate the games themselves. But the Nazis basically, like they did so often, imitated previously successful sort of endeavors. And the fascists in Italy were the prime example of how sport was frankly easily corrupted. The players themselves, of course, were in almost a no-win sort of position, because they loved to play the game. They realized that the political forces at that time, of course, were ascendant. dominant. But for me, that was the draw. And the interwar period, I think, is essential to telling the story of soccer during the Holocaust, because we can see why the Nazis eventually wanted to use it for a time until the war, of course, turns against them. But they wanted to use it at the time because they saw how popular the game had become in the 20s, especially the 1930s as well, with the World Cup garnering the world's attention and so on. And, of course, it's Mussolini's fascists who made the most of it with the victories in 1934 and 1938 in the World Cup. Of course, all the photographs with Mussolini and the national team. I really wanted to include those in my book, but it was just a bit farther afield than I could. But when the Nazis kind of get a hold of the game, they had some trial runs with the matches against the English. And there were two matches in particular that stand out, 1936, 1938. And again, this is the era of appeasement, especially from the British perspective. They realize the horrors of World War I. They want to avoid those. And sport, as again, an extension of the state, was certainly part of the British story as well. But again, the Nazis essentially are imitating what the fascists had done successfully, but they never really quite got it right. And part of it was that even amid the passion for soccer that especially the German populace had, they still tried to bring it back around to particular Nazi ideals. And that's where, again, when you have men like von Schammer trying to bring in the Nazi state into it, they really don't understand the sport. And again, this may seem a triviality when, in fact, enemies of the state have already been rounded up for a number of years in the Nazi scheme of things. But the games that mattered were, of course, against the presumed masters of the game. And of course, those were the British. And so when the games are played in Berlin and then later on English soil, the Germans are not going to win these games, but they enjoy the propaganda victory they offer. In fact, when I teach about this here at JBU, I'm always mindful to use the clip that shows, again, the infamous Nazi salute that the English give in May 1938. This is, again, a match that's played, again, with the storms of war gathering, basically. And there are interviews later on, and it's fantastic to compare the interviews right after the match when you look at the newspapers, especially the British newspapers, of the players, the British players themselves. And then later on, Stanley Matthews, the famous winger of that era, certainly one of the best British players ever. You look at his kind of account after the match, and they weren't bothered by it much. Of course, they don't know what's to come, you know, just a mere 18 months later in terms of World War II. But they weren't bothered by it much. The demand, the request made by the FA for them to give the salute, again, they did it. A few were bothered, but it's later on when the significance of that moment is better realized that there's a bit of revisionism there. And in fact, some sports historians and writers have recognized this tendency. And you know how this is when we read sports memoirs, we're careful. But in this instance, there's certainly some revisionism there. And Matthews later on realizes that they were disgusted by it. But in fact, when you look at the accounts, that really wasn't the case. It's just fascinating that when you really look at the player accounts, and you see this, I think, in the survivor accounts as well, that really is fascinating to compare again what was happening in the era with what is perceived and better understood in the years that followed. But for me, that again was crucial to telling the story later on, because you need to understand the ascendancy of the game. One of the books that was really influential to me in my work is the book by David Goldblatt, The Ball is Round.
And great book. Yeah.
I highly recommend that to your listeners. But he, again, reminds us that it's not just a European sort of phenomenon. Of course, Europe may be, again, the birthplace of the game, with maybe some debate there. But that it's, of course, South America that really takes on the game with that full-throated passion, which, of course, is why Uruguay wins the very first World Cup. And we see, again, the game propelled from there.
One of the things I think you're able to do really well in the first few chapters of the book is integrate this history of soccer in with the story of German expansion before World War II, in particular with the Anschluss, and then German inability to integrate so many of these great Austrian players from this Wunder team into the German team and how that leads to, in some ways, to their failure in the 38 World Cup. And so I wondered if you could talk to us a little bit about how this German inability to incorporate these Wunder Team players is also in some ways related to the history of German or of Jewish soccer in Central Europe, and to what extent are Jewish footballers kind of creating this Central European football story?
Oh, that's a fantastic question. I think the story of the Austrian brilliance in that era, especially in the early 30s, along with what would come later on in the Hungarian sort of brilliance that we see lasting even into the 1950s, is really important.
Yeah, these magic Magyars, exactly. Right?
One of the stories that, again, captivated my interest in this was the story of Matthias Sindelar. So after the Anschluss, when essentially this brilliant Austrian team, which again competed at very, very high levels, had an unbeaten streak that was almost unparalleled for the era, when they were forced essentially to blend with their German now compatriots, it was doomed from the very start, because in fact you had, and this was true for many of the footballers who came from the streets of Vienna and even from places like Budapest and Prague, whether or not they were Jewish, many of these players, like the Brazilian players of today and maybe Argentine as well, they came from these very poor sort of backgrounds. And Sindelar was an example of this. So in as much as they developed their cultured, sophisticated football, well, it comes from these proletariat kind of roots. And again, the Nazis would reject this out of hand, because they would see this, of course, as a refutation of their notion, of course, of superior races. But when you really get down into that history with players like Matthias Sindelar, again, I'd love to have somebody needs to write a biography, an English biography of this man, because there's this famous story of the Anschluss match when the Austrians are going to be playing the Germans. There's this story of Sindelar, who is a little bit later in his career, but still shows these flares of brilliance, where he scores again a goal against this German squad, supposedly again to bring together the two teams. But he comes back to the center box at midfield and essentially dances a jig, gets away with as much as he can there without going too far over the line. But the Austrian fans, of course, are rapturous because there's just a longer lasting, I think, animosity to Germany for a number of reasons. And some of this does come, of course, from the history that Austria has of always looking over their shoulder for Germany, who's, of course, wanting to expand its borders. But the beautiful football that's played in Central Europe in this era, I think Jonathan Wilson is finishing a book on this kind of in this moment, is part of the tragedy, frankly, of the Jewish story in Central Europe. Besides the Holocaust that, again, will descend upon Central Europe in the years that followed, before World War II, the most innovative coaches, the Meisel brothers are an example of this, are coming from, again, Central Europe. The most creative football, the formations that are played, again, Wilson has written about this in Inverting the Pyramid. It's all coming from this. And many of the footballers, of course, are of Jewish descent, of Jewish background. But when you really do look at that history, it's that birth of the brilliance where players learn the game on their own, much like I think we'd see with basketball here in the United States, where players can learn creativity without too much coaching. Certainly need to learn the technical side of the game and be fluid that way. But that's really where this is coming from. And again, some of the most innovative coaches are in that Jewish tradition. We see this in the story of Hakoa Vienna. They win the championship in Austria in 1926, I believe. And again, many of those Jewish players go on to influence many, many other teams. Bela Gutmann's example of this. I didn't spend much time in my book talking about him, but there's a recent biography by his name is pronounced David Bolkover, a journalist in England who published this just in the last year, and his influence on teams like Benfica and some other teams in South America, I believe, is just astounding. And it's just one example of many of these Jewish footballers in Vienna, Hakoa Vienna being this this birthplace of some of these coaches and players, and that spread. And certainly teams like MTK in Budapest, another example there. And that's part of the tragedy as well, that some of these footballers were lost to the Holocaust. Arpad Weiss, a number of other footballers who simply didn't survive the war, but before were very influential again in their play, their technique, and again their vision for what football could be.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that your book really does. And I think one of the reasons why it's important for people to read is that it recaptures in many ways the history of this Jewish athleticism in Central Europe in the years before the war. I think there's a trope, and it certainly was common in this time in Nazi propaganda, that Jews were effete and over urbane and therefore not athletic. And that was part of the reason why this intermixing between Jews and Germans, and here nobody can see this, but I'm giving scare quotes, would contribute to the degeneracy of the German race. But actually, there's this amazing history of Jewish athleticism, and that athleticism continues in very surprising places in your book. And I'd turn us now to chapters 4, 6, and 8, and I'm going to give the names of the chapters here for people who don't have the book in front of them, but the beautiful game in the KZ or in the Konzentrationslager, right? Football in the Polish killing fields, eyewitnesses to Nazi terror, and ghetto soccer in the Liga Terezin. I'm wondering if you can tell us more about how soccer emerges in these places, in the Konzentrationslager, in Terezin, even in Auschwitz. And why are people playing soccer there? That seems so astounding, but you just show in each instance that it's happening everywhere. So I'd love for you to talk to us a little bit about that.
Certainly. I'd probably prefer to take them by their unique sort of locale, partly because the camps themselves change over the course of the war. Dachau is a prime example of this. Some of the very first photos I came across in my research were prisoners playing in Dachau just a few months after it opened. So this would be June 1933. Two of them appear in my book. And to be brief, you see men running around in tattered clothing. They're barefoot. They're kicking around that old leather ball. But of course, these were propaganda photos that were distributed to the newspapers in Bavaria. And again, these prisoners most likely would have been communists, social democrats, anarchists possibly. So in other words, political enemies of the state. And they weren't necessarily Jewish initially, but we find that as you go again across both time and locale, the game really does have a unique sort of way of popping up. Another example of this is when you see stories of boxing, even track and field events popping up in camps. Boxing is probably the second most popular pursuit, in part because the prisoners themselves, especially if they were maybe of a Polish background, this might be a way for them in a more leveled sort of way to extract a type of revenge. They might be boxing a German capo who is a criminal who's lorded over them for months as a way, again, to get inside the ring and get a few licks in, basically. But Dachau, the game, wasn't as well organized as it was in other places. When I think about where it emerged most prominently, Terezin is the most well-known example. It had the best organization. I'll come back to talking about that here in a second because we know the most about it. But the game was also played in Mauthausen. Again, depending on where the camp was or ghetto was in terms of its contribution to the Nazi devastation, the game, again, might have appeared for a time and then went dormant, went away, and then new prisoners came through who maybe were deported later in the war, maybe of healthier body, more stronger constitution. In other words, from the start, they hadn't been starved in a ghetto, and so they were able to play. But Mauthausen, again, we have the most records we have are very late in the war. And again, these were prisoners who had maybe been in the camp longer, so they had protected status, what we call prominentin sort of status. Again, the accounts are rather scattered. So when we go to other camps like Neuengamme or Sachsenhausen, again, the game kind of emerges for a year, maybe 18 months, and then it goes away. Buchenwald is an example of this as well. But within Terezin, again, it's just a remarkable case because the prisoners who maybe were there from 1942 on, maybe if they're able to survive until the deportations in late 1944, they might have, again, been known before their arrival by train car. And so many of these players would have been plucked from the registration line early on and taken again to a special barracks, maybe, where, again, they were given extra food if they were already assigned to a team. And that was one of the most bizarre details for me when I looked at the league at Terezin, that on Mondays there would be essentially a transfer list that would have been submitted. So players who might have been deported, again, not to be too glib about this, but players who've been, quite frankly, deported to their death. Auschwitz was the next stop, basically, after Terezin. But there would be an afternoon sort of reassignment of players. Any players that came in, like a transfer window, basically, and players reassigned. So just it shows just how important the league was to not only those who ran it, but those, of course, who played in it and those who were spectators as well. But in terms of linking of that all together, I think it's important to note that the leagues themselves were pretty idiosyncratic to the site. I know I said that earlier, but it bears repeating. For instance, in Gross Rosen, a camp in Silesia, basically near Wrocław in Western Poland, there was a league there in the dusty Apoplatz, the gathering center, where, of course, prisoners were forced to stand for hours on end. But again, there was a league there for a time until, again, the war goes against the Nazis and players are sent either on marches or by train back into Germany proper. But a little bit more about Terezin, if I could. Again, the league emerged fairly early on, 42-43. The first competitive matches were played. There were, in fact, special cup tournaments that were often held. There were amateur leagues. There were youth leagues. By most accounts, the games that were played at the highest level probably included as many as 600 or more players at any given, not any given time, over in totality there. The youth, again, were captivated by it. When you look at the children's newspaper accounts, again, the Jewish boys' home often had newspapers that were published of different events in life in the ghetto. Soccer featured very prominently. That memoir account from Pavel Wiener that I mentioned earlier, A Boy in Terezin, talks a lot about this, that sometimes headmasters or parents themselves would use the soccer matches as motivation or in some cases punishments if a young boy misbehaved. Again, they of course wanted to bring back as much normalcy as possible in these places. But again, you could imagine these spectators of whatever age going to watch these matches, especially on Sunday afternoon with the professional level league. They'd be going there in various stages of starvation, but yet they drew real energy, real hope, real passion by watching these players play. There are a number of accounts as well where players were, of course, given, like I said, protection privilege, but extra rations. And oftentimes spectators who had maybe a personal connection to the players or maybe the kitchen who provided the rations didn't mind giving up their ration card to a player if maybe that could sustain that player for a little bit longer. So it's remarkable the sacrifices that went on to keep these games going on. Like I said, there were professional level administrators, basically referees, were there as well. There'd be disciplinary hearings and boards for players who misbehaved, and the SS as well were betting on the games. You see this across a number of camps as well. Buchenwald, Sachsenhausen, the SS had a vested interest in this as well. And again, depending on the commandants, some of the commandants were more permissive, more accepting of this. But oftentimes, if the SS leadership came in and found out this was going on, there would often be a crackdown, partly again, this assumption that there shouldn't be any sort of hope given to the prisoners themselves.
Yeah, I it's all just so incredible in some ways. I think there's two paths of questions I'd like to go down. The first is this question that you just raised there, which is why the Nazis allowed the games to begin with. Sometimes it seems like there's maybe a sense that there's a soccer fraternity at work and that crosses culture and crosses the line between perpetrator and victim, and maybe even at times brings them close together. And I was struck several times in your book by accounts of prisoners when they're playing guards shaking their hands before the game.
Yes, astounding. So,
and then at the same time, there's a sense that in some ways sports could be a punishment. And here you think, I think more of a boxing and people like Victor Young Perez, who literally were you know, forced to box against people much larger than them, and that Young Perez's victories against a much larger Nazi opponent again gave rise to this sense of hope, but he was never expected to win, right? So I'm wondering if you could explain a little bit, tell us a little bit about why the Nazis allowed these games, how much of this is related to this broader kind of idea of a sports fraternity, or were the Nazis using sports as a way to reify their own categories of racial superiority, or what's going on here?
Well, I think it's all of that, but a more direct answer would be to recognize that, again, within the idiosyncratic nature of the camps, there certainly would be, I think the predominant view, let me say it this way, the predominant view would be that for most people who were able to write a memoir after the Holocaust, they remember sport in very different terms. They saw it again as an instrument of torture. There's a fantastic book that came out a number of years ago, Watercolors and Drawings by Cantor, Alfred Cantor, I believe is his name. And one of those shows in very grim detail, essentially, how sport was used for the elderly and the weak to essentially break them down even further. So that's the, I think, the first and foremost understanding we ought to take here, that the Nazis more often use what they would call sport, gymnastics, something of this sort, as a way to break people down. But in these isolated instances where there was a type of fraternity, again, it was usually done through the capos. So the SS would use their intermediaries, their functionaries in the camps to do this. But in some cases, it would be part of the corruption as well, again, depending on the betting schemes that were part of it. But there are instances where there seems to be a more leveling sort of effect. And you more often found this outside of the SS control, where there might be a Wehrmacht soldier or players who were assigned to a Luftwaffe detail who were playing in a league. That the prime example of this were soldiers from the Nazi forces playing against players in Ukraine and Kiev. Again, there was a league there. In fact, that the wonderfully campy film Victory that starred Michael Caine and Sylvester Stallone back in the 80s is a blend of some of these stories, even though it's in a POW sort of camp. It's based, again, on some of the accounts of the FC Start team in Kiev, a cobbled together group of former players, primarily from Dinamo Kiev, who eventually went on to play not only Yugoslavian enlistees and other teams, but prisoner-based teams, but also, of course, an SS team, or I'm sorry, a Luftwaffe team. And that's where you're more likely to find that that brotherhood of sport sort of thing. There's an account, you probably came across it, of some soldiers playing some Jewish children in the Warsaw Ghetto. Chaim Kaplan remembers this in his diary. And in fact, again, by all accounts that we have, which again are few, but we find that this to be a true tale of the Jewish boys beating the soldiers. And again, they weren't footballers probably necessarily, but they were looking for diversion. And again, one thing to remember is that quite often in these camps and ghettos, there was a lot of downtime. And again, I don't want to be trivial about this, but both prisoners and, of course, the guards themselves are looking for diversions, and soccer was primary among them. We see this in Vesterbork. Some of the prisoner accounts there are pretty vivid in the way they describe how the game, again, meant something to the staff running the camp. So not only the functionaries, but, of course, the guards themselves. I would add as well, when you look at Terezin, I think it was tolerated in part because they saw it as a pacification as well. a way again to keep prisoners from maybe thinking about insurrection, revolt, this sort of thing, as we find with some of the revolts that did happen in the death camps, Sobibor and Treblinka, and eventually Auschwitz. This is when you also start to see some of these diversions start to go away. So the crackdown comes. But before that, it's a way to pass the time in camps, again, that had their moments of atrocity, but then moments of silence and downtime. And so I think that's part of the reason why it was tolerated. Also, keep in mind, too, that within the SS structure, the notion, again, of a physically fit soldier is highly valued, and sport would be one of these examples. There are a fair number of accounts of the SS team from Mauthausen traveling to even as far away as Berlin to play matches as well, and vice versa. So this is part, again, of the Nazi ideal for the fit SS man. And that's trickling down essentially into the camps, especially with the functionaries who are the intermediaries.
The other pathway I'd love to go down, and for me, the real power in some ways of your book is exploring why prisoners in the camp played. You cited at some length in your chapter on football in the Polish killing fields, Primo Levi, who talks about this gray zone, and that perhaps soccer was also a kind of area in which people were participating in this gray zone or living in a gray zone. I'd love to hear more about how soccer could work or could help contribute to the survival of both of prisoners, but also how maybe later it engendered certain feelings of guilt. I'd wonder if you could tell us more about that.
So, yeah, that's a fantastic question. Let me say that Primo Levi, in his inimitable way, reminds us that because we often expect winners and losers in sport, we ought to really set that aside when we consider sport within the concentration camp, because there is this moral ambiguity, as he calls it, that exists in the camp. Because in as much as, of course, there's a hierarchy and there's a system of patronage and privilege, we must acknowledge that in our expectation for winners and losers, that anytime sport is played in these places, we need to read very carefully. We need to account for this very carefully. And the players themselves engage in this moral calculation, essentially. And let me, in fact, read a passage. I just happen to have a bookmark in that section that you're talking about. Inasmuch, again, as prisoners recognize the compromise they're making, there's a fantastic memoir account of a young man named Louis de Vija in Vesterbork. He also went on to be imprisoned in Monowitz and then eventually Buchenwald, where he was liberated. But I'll get to that here in a second. But here's what Levy has to say regarding this moral calculation. This is certainly the reason for the enormous popularity of spectator sports such as soccer, baseball, and boxing. The contenders are two teams or two individuals, clearly distinct and identifiable, and at the end of the match, there are vanquished and victors. If the result is a draw, the spectator feels defrauded and disappointed. At the more unconscious level, he wanted winners and losers, which he identified with the good guys and the bad guys, respectively, because the good must prevail. Otherwise, the world would be subverted. Again, when we recognize that the prisoners themselves may have had the simple motivation to survive, and again, the privilege and protection that might allow, we acknowledge that guilt did come. And prisoners, or survivors after the war, are asking this question of themselves anyway. Why me? Why did I survive? And especially if you were able to take advantage, quite frankly, of the special protection, that's going to be amplified even more. As I mentioned earlier, Louis de Vija, again, he's a first division player before the war. He plays in Vesterbork a bit, but also Monowitz, which there was a slave labor camp too. He acknowledges that the only motivation that accounts, that really matters, is survival, of course. And he acknowledges that there are all sorts of examples of this in the camp, when people are stealing from each other, when you're negotiating, so to speak, or what they call organizing, quote unquote. You're simply trying to get extra bread, covers for your feet, any sort of objects that you can trade on the black market. This is how they live from day to day. They don't think any farther than tomorrow. In fact, here's an excerpt from his memoir that I think explains this really well. And there's a great rejoinder to the end of it here. "We don't think any farther than tomorrow. Yesterday is gone. And when Sunday comes and your unit, thank God, doesn't have to work that day, the hours slip away like water in your hand. Those who still can walk in small groups throughout the camp. One day without yelling capos, beating guards. But for most people, a single day to regain one strength is insufficient. Sunday, for a lot of people, is just a day to start worrying about Monday. When I put on my squeaky clean, freshly ironed soccer attire and walk on the pitch with my teammates, I feel incredibly privileged compared with the masses. During that hour and a half of sports competition, nothing matters but the leather ball and the goal, just like old times." Later on, when you read his memoir, we find that inasmuch as he acknowledges this very special place that he inhabited in these camps, we learn that during one of the deadly selections, in fact, in Monowitz, he gives up his bundle of clothing to an emaciated prisoner that he calls Hugo, I believe was a Czech prisoner, and pushes the man into the line of life and then goes back through the selection again with a very real possible real risk of he himself being selected for extermination at Birkenau. And so again, there's certainly this ambiguity. Levy certainly talks about it, but when you go to the other survivors, we see it in full picture.
Yeah, I think it's just astounding reading in your book the difficulties that many of the prisoners faced when they were having to come up with the materials, the extra food, to make these games possible. But then at the same time, you remembered there is this Promenten system, so they're benefiting in some ways from their participation. It's a really complicated story. I'd turn us now to your final chapter, which in some ways I found to be really one of my favorite. Maybe I liked it because in some ways it turns more towards the power of sports optimism. But can you tell me more about how sports were being used in the DP camps, the displaced person camps?
Yes, it was all part of the general motivation to restore life as best as the survivors could. Of course, there's a baby boom in the DP camps. Synagogues, yeshivas, schools are being reestablished as quickly as possible. Again, not only a return to normalcy, but a reclaiming of Jewish life and Jewish culture. Cabarets, orchestras, dramas are being put on again. But sport again emerges. And there's a very robust set of leagues in the different occupation zones. The most well-attended, most robust leagues, I guess you could say, were in fact in the British and American zones. And again, there are a number of accounts there. I really wanted to go farther with that particular chapter, but as I needed to kind of wrap things up, I really hit the highlights. But there are many more stories, I think, that come after that, because my goal really, and I wish I'd mentioned this earlier in our talk today, my goal was to bring forward these stories, because as a teacher of the Holocaust, we're not too far away from losing these witnesses. They're going to be lost to history here pretty soon. And I tell this to my students all the time. You're probably going to hear this on the news, and my hope is that they feel compelled to tell others about the story. And I know that's maybe a little idealistic on my part, but it's pretty basic in that when we see Jewish survivors trying to reclaim their lives, it's also, again, a refutation, a direct rejection of what the Nazis were trying to do. Of course, again, they often targeted women and children the most devastatingly. And the DP camps, again, were a way to not only get back to one's life amid the reality that probably one didn't have their family remaining. But again, the leagues themselves primarily were populated with young men, again, who were able to survive maybe in hiding or had maybe gone to the East and found protection there. But they were, again, were populated by young men, in some cases, young women, who, again, wanted to get back to normal. Let us put the war behind us, they would say, and find, again, the zeal for life that was almost taken from us.
Yeah, for many of the young men that you're writing about, it really felt like they were trying to reassert their masculinity and in some ways recapitulate themselves as a group of men. But something you touch on again and again and again is the way in which sport helps these prisoners to reassert their humanity under extremely inhumane conditions. And so I wondered if maybe there's something unique about this story. Is sport, is soccer in particular, was it just the most popular thing, or is there something about sport for you that helped them in particular ways reassert their humanity in a way that maybe a study of music during the Holocaust or theater, even literature, might not have been able to accomplish?
I think the unique contribution of sports, maybe in a way that music or literature wouldn't offer, is the collaborative nature of it, in as much as certainly you can, in an orchestra, for instance, or reviving maybe a work that a Jewish composer who perished in the Holocaust might have composed after the war. I think there's something about the collective nature of soccer that's simply fantastic. Having played the sport since I was a young boy, lucky enough to play it through my college years and in my old man leagues where I take it way too seriously, there's this realization that collectively soccer offers something that I think many other sports don't offer. And again, this may not be surprising for somebody who simply loves the game like I do or we do, but I think it offers a sense of collectivism. And I don't necessarily mean that in a political sense, but it offers a sense of collectivism because the best teams are the ones that may not have the standout players. And when I think back, 60, 70 years, what was happening right after the war, part of the reason why, frankly, the West German team wins the 1954 World Cup over the Hungarians is because of that collective nature that with the passion that comes with playing together and playing within a system that rewards real unity. I think there's something to be said about that in this particular account as well. And there are other sports that they draw upon that. I think rugby is a good example of that too. But I think there's just something unique about the beautiful game that brings this forward, where the team who shouldn't win sometimes does, or we again see that brilliance manifested again through the shared effort. What I would say about immediately after the war, maybe kind of in closing related to that, is that in the DP camps, again, is whether or not the games were well played, and sometimes there is that question, and maybe it seems an irrelevant sort of question, but it probably doesn't matter in the end, because and you know this, I think, if you play the game at all, there are those moments when you just go out for a kickabout or a pickup match, and it just helps you distract from whatever distractions are there. Certainly when we engage in exercise, we do the same sort of thing. But there's one account, if I can track this down, I can almost talk about it from memory here. There's a Czech author named Ernst Lustig. He was a 15-year-old, I think, in Theresienstadt during the war. And he talks again about his experiences playing goalie in one of the matches at the youth level there. But for him, he talks about soccer as being a wonderful combination between art and exercise, that the ability to create among a brilliant sort of player like a Sindelar years ago or a Messi or even a Ronaldo nowadays, there's just something again about the freedom that comes, that a brilliant play might not ever be replicated again in a particular soccer match, but we can appreciate it for what it is. And it's really why many of us love the game, whether or not it's a 4-3 score, that sometimes we can find brilliance in a 0-0 draw. I used to tease mercilessly by my non-soccer playing father for this sort of thing. But later on, I think he came to appreciate the game. But I think it really does not only unite, but in these instances, it was defiance. There's beauty in it, and this notion of possibility of living. because so many did perish, right? So many accounts are not recorded of those who loved the game and perished during the war or during the Holocaust. One last little line here, if I could read. Hopefully I'm not giving you too much of this here, but it's from Lustig. In fact, I close my book with this excerpt, and this is the last half of it here. And this is, again, a man who taught, I think, at American University in D.C. well into his 60s, maybe 70s. And he was famous, Lustig was, for playing pickup matches with the international kids on the greens there of the campus there in D.C. But here's what he has to say. Soccer is joy and peace, a beautiful game that changes life into joy, the gratification of defiance. Thoughts about soccer in Terezin and anywhere else, I would conclude with two sentences. Let the game called soccer live. While it is played, a person on this earth will stay human. And for me, again, that was a perfect way to end the book, to let the survivor speak, especially, like I said, since we're losing so many of these survivors month by month, year by year.
Yeah, that quote at the end of the book was so powerful. Again, I encourage all our listeners to pick up a copy of Soccer Under the Swastika, Stories of Survival and Resistance During the Holocaust by Dr. Kevin Simpson. Kevin, can you tell me what your next project is?
Given that this book kind of came mid-career, I had no notions of writing a book over the years. I'm more of kind of a journal level sort of writer. I'm captivated, continue to be captivated. And one story in particular, I talk a bit about a gentleman named Ignaz Feldman, who was part of the Hakoah Vienna team back in the 1920s. This is a man who I think in his time was very charismatic, very persuasive, but he managed to survive the war when he was part of the earliest roundup because he was an Austrian Jew. And we see him actually at the end of the war walking around with Eisenhower and Bradley and other American high top military brass in the camp at Ohrdruf that was liberated by the Americans. And you immediately recognize his face because he has a boxer's nose. It's tilted, I think, violently to the left. But this is a man who started a league in Vesterbork. The fantastic story of him coming back on a train, hearing about players playing in other parts of Europe. And he thought, well, why can't we do this in Vesterbork? And so he does this. So there's not a lot known about him, but I want to dig pretty deep to find those stories. It's just a compelling account, someone who probably shouldn't have survived, but did, and was a footballer himself. So his name's Ignaz Feldman. I'm lucky enough to be able to do a Fulbright teaching fellowship in Slovakia next spring, 2019. And I'll be in Bratislava, just a few minutes down the river from Vienna. So I'll spend a fair amount of time over there as much as I can to research his story.
Wow, it sounds fascinating. And you'll have to, of course, let me know when that monograph length book on Ignaz comes out. Thank you again, Kevin, for joining us here on New Books in Sports. This book today, again, was Soccer Under the Swastika, Stories of Survival and Resistance During the Holocaust. I encourage everyone to pick up a copy. Thank you again, Kevin.
Thank you, Keith. This is a real pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the New Books in Sports podcast. I'm Keith Rathbone, and we've been speaking with Kevin Simpson about his book, Soccer Under the Swastika. If you enjoyed our discussion, you will undoubtedly enjoy some of the other podcasts we have on the New Books Network. Until next time. Thank you for listening.